I don't think I've ever been introduced as anyone's senior colleague before. How much do I owe you for the microphone?
I told you that would happen.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, I don't know how I could be the senior colleague if I am as young as I think I am in my own mind, but it's a pleasure to be here to see everyone here in Boynton once again. And I'm grateful to my dear chaver, my good friend and colleague, my junior colleague, Rabbi Billet, for inviting me once again. So this series, I understand, is really about developing a relationship with the different components of Torah, to understand Medrash and Agada, to understand Gemara. And my charge or my mission tonight, as it was assigned to me, is to talk about the transition from a biblical lifestyle, what the world was like when we followed the strict biblical law, laws d'oraisa, before the rabbis left their fingerprints on our lives, and the transition to our way of life, which we sometimes underappreciate how rabbinically driven it is. If we don't have a deep knowledge base, we don't really know the difference necessarily, and that's sometimes very dangerous. So we're not going to describe all of biblical versus rabbinic law in the limited time that we have here tonight, but I can encourage you strongly enough, in your own personal learning, to always ask, as one of my rebbeim did in Shir, Rav Schechter, with every Gemara we learn, it would begin with, what's the pasuk this law is derived from? What's the Mishnah? Where do we get from it to the Gemara? How do you get to the Halacha? And to have a working knowledge of the difference between D'oraisa, biblical law, D'rabbanan, a rabbinic law, a minhag, a binding custom, and something which is even less than a custom, something which might just be a nice practice. Tragically, sadly, I sometimes see people are confused. They just know what a Torah lifestyle they think is supposed to look like today, and they don't have the knowledge to differentiate or to categorize the origin of the law, how binding it is, how flexible it is based on the community. And I'll give you just one example. Some have a custom of an upsharing, or some communities call it an upsharnish, for a boy not to get a haircut the first 3 years of their life. And it's a wonderful custom, it's widely kept, particularly in the Hasidic community, some Sfaradim, but not all people do. So when we had our son, after six girls, we did not, even though my wife comes from a Hungarian Hasidic family who has the custom of an upsharing, she did not want to, after having six little girls, have a boy who people would say, what a cute little girl. And since my custom, I couldn't have an upsharing now if I wanted to, as you can see, but my family custom was not to have an upsharing. We gave him haircuts right away. And my wife ran into people, not necessarily from our community, who, not so strict in the world of modesty or in keeping kosher, some may not even be fully Shabbos observant or going to the mikvah, but reacted incredulously. How could you give him a haircut before he's three? As if upsharing is yarek v'yavor. To not touch a boy's hair is one of the cardinal rules, inviolate. You absolutely can't do it. I give it to you as a small example. There's nothing wrong with observing upsharing. There's nothing wrong with not observing it. That's one of those customs. It depends on your family background. It depends on your community. But if you're ignorant, if you don't lack the knowledge to put in category and understand where the law comes from, it could confuse your own practice, your own hierarchy, your own priorities, and by extension, sadly, your own judgment of others, which often is really uninformed. So that's my assignment for tonight. And before I begin my assignment, I want to take a step back to just talk about the difference between biblical law and rabbinic law. Because biblical law is not just the verses that we see in the Torah. D'oraisa, biblical law, does not mean open a chumash and what you read is biblical law, and if it doesn't appear there, it's rabbinic law. That's not true. And if you're on time to davening, you know that that's not true. Because the last thing that you can be there for before the first Kaddish of the day is Rabbi Yishmael. And what does Rabbi Yishmael, that section of Birchas HaShachar, teach us? It teaches the 13 hermeneutical laws. It teaches us the 13 principles, the tools and instruments the rabbis were given to derive and extrapolate from the verses of the Torah of the Bible and to extrapolate from it biblical law. That means to say that we have biblical laws, we have D'oraisa laws that don't appear in the Torah explicitly, sometimes not even implicitly. The rabbis had to use their creative tools and instruments they were given in order to derive and extract those rules. It's a very interesting aside. There's an incredible Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish says When the rabbis would apply the Yud Gimel Midos, when the rabbis would take those 13 instruments and they would use them, Kal Vachomer, we say them all in Davening, and they would learn a new law. Did they reveal a law that was there all along, and those who had not yet observed it are now culpable or liable for the new, for the law that had been true all along but was only revealed now? Or when they apply the instrument to extract the law, did the law become new from now going forward? Or in halachic terminology, when the rabbis applied the Yud Gimel Midos, did the law apply l'mafreya retroactively, or mikan l'haba only going forward? And the Chazon Ish says, based on a pasuk that we read, Kohelis, that ein chadash tachas hashemesh, tachas hashemayim. Sometimes it uses one, sometimes it uses the other, which is also very instructive, but not our topic for tonight. And the Chazon Ish says, while it's true there's nothing in the physical universe, nothing new under the sun, in the spiritual universe, we can have something new. And so when the rabbis use their tools to derive law, it's mikana lahaba. It is derived going forward. They have introduced something new to the world. So we have biblical law, like you open a chumash and you read a pasuk, and the pasuk tells you that you have to take a preetz adar, kapost marim, anaf etz avos, arvei nachal, the four species. I read I have to take the four species, I got to take the four species. Sometimes we have biblical law that is derived by applying the 13 principles, these instruments. Sometimes we have what we call halacha l'Moshe Mi-Sinai. That we read in last week's parsha, 2 weeks ago's parsha, Moshe ascended the mountain, God gave him the Torah. He not only, by the way, God did not give him the Torah in the sense that God handed him an Artscroll Chumash or a Hertz Chumash or a Koran Chumash or a Rabbi Sachs Chumash that's coming out soon. God didn't hand Moshe a Chumash. God taught Moshe the laws. He gave Moshe a sense of a vision of how he wanted the world run. And then, each time an event occurred, God would summon Moshe to the Ol Moed, to the tent of meeting. He would dictate how he wants that event recorded for posterity. Moshe would scribble it down. When Moshe said, "Could you give me a minute to absorb, to think about what you just said or taught?" We have a break in the text. If you look in a Torah scroll, what were called were psuchos and stumos. Sometimes you have a blank space, the words then continue on the line. Sometimes you have a blank space where it begins with a new paragraph on the next line. And that reflects how much time Moshe took to think about, to absorb, to integrate what God had just shared with him. And at the end of Moshe's life, he took all these scraps of paper and he combined them and sewed them together to make the very first Torah scroll, which would explain why, according to some opinions, Ein Muktam Amuchar BaTorah, the Torah is not recorded chronologically, it's recorded thematically. Because when Moshe took those scraps of paper or parchment and sewed them together based on God's instruction and direction, it's possible God told them to create a theme for the book rather than record historically or chronologically how it unfolded. So God didn't hand Moshe a chumash on Har Sinai. He taught him laws. Some of those laws would then appear explicitly in the chumash, but some of them were just passed down through tradition. And the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos tells us, Moshe gave it to Yoshua, to the Zekanim, to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, and the Shalshelas HaMesora, the chain of our tradition, how those laws that were given to Moshe that don't appear in the text, but are nevertheless biblically true, were passed on person to person to person. The Rambam writes, "Af al pi shedvarim elo nirim me'inyan Torah shebechsav, kulam mefurashnim mipi Moshe mehar Sinai. Kulam halacha lemaisa biyadeinu, ukezer roa vaseinu, danim bebeis dinu shel Yoshua, bebeis dinu shel Shmuel," and so on and so forth. So, we have the biblical laws as they appear in the Torah. The rabbis were then empowered to teach us other biblical law or to extrapolate what the biblical law means. There was a group, there were multiple groups. We had the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, we had the Karaites, the Karaim, who did not accept the rabbinic tradition of how to interpret the biblical law. They said, whatever it says in the text, that's what we take at face value, and your interpretation about what the text really means to tell me, I reject. I'll give you three quick examples. Number one, Torah tells us, "Lo savaru esh b'chol moshvoseichem," you're not allowed to light a fire in all your dwelling places. Came along the Karaites and they said, it says you can't have a fire in your dwelling place. So Karaites would sit in the dark, in the cold, with no access to fire to heat them, to illuminate, or to warm their food. However, the rabbis came along and said, no, lo sevaru esh b'chol moshu aseichem doesn't mean you can't have a pre-existing fire continue to be lit on Shabbos. It means you can't ignite a new fire. So if you have a fire that you lit from before Shabbos, b'gezunt, let it light the room. Enjoy its warmth. Let it continue to warm your food. And I'll tell you something incredible that many of you may not know, and it's one of my favorite halachas. It's one of my favorite fascinating details of halacha. It is a mitzvah to eat shalat. It is a mitzvah to eat shalat. What do I mean by that? First of all, the word shalat, the name for that stew that we allow to bake overnight from before Shabbos, that name shalat already appears in the 13th century in the Or Zarua. One of the great Rishonim, one of the great medieval commentaries, already alludes to the use of that word, chalant. Why is he talking about chalant? It precedes even the Or Zarua. The Balamor of Zrachya Halevi, who lived in Spain in the 1100s, the mid-1100s, writes that there was a takanas chachamim, there was a rabbinic enactment in his time that would challenge people to eat hot food on Shabbos day. And you would invite someone over and you'd present to them, would you like a bowl of my chalant? And if they said no, you had to be suspicious that they were a min, that they were not bikoris. You had to suspect them of being a heretic, of being a Sadducee or a Karite. Because why might they be rejecting the chalant? Not because they're on a gluten-free or Atkins diet or watching their weight. They're rejecting it because how could they eat hot food after all? It says, Lo sevaru esh b'chol moshu aseichem. So says the Baal Amor, the Or Zarua quotes and calls it chalan. We have a tradition going back almost 1,000 years to eat hot food on Shabbos day to affirm that we in fact adopt rabbinic Judaism, rabbinic interpretation of the biblical law. The words of the Baal Amor are codified by the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Mishnah Brura says, eating hot food on Shabbos day is a minag Yisrael. It's a binding custom among the Jewish people. A person should be strict with this. When I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, my mother made chalent seasonally. In the summers, we were often chalent. A long hot walk back from shul, nobody wanted chalent. She had the minag. But if you're not going to have chalent, then you need to have a hot cup of tea. There is, the Mishnah Berurah says, one should try to be vigilant and strict to taste something hot. One bean, one sip of hot tea, access to something warm on Shabbos day, so that you know that your guests around the table are all Prushim, that they all believe in the oral tradition, not just in the biblical text. Another example. Torah tells us that where do we wear our tefillin? Totafos bein einecha. Without the rabbinic interpretation of what the biblical law is, there were those who wore their tefillin literally between their eyes. The rabbis come along and say, it doesn't mean between the eyes, literally. Now, the rabbis are not introducing a rabbinic law when they say that you can have a pre-existing fire on Shabbos. They're not introducing a rabbinic law when they say that tefillin don't belong literally between the eyes. They are using their tools and instruments and tradition to reveal what the biblical law is all along. A third and final example, Shavuos. When is Shavuos? 49 days after the first day of Pesach. But that's not what the Torah says. It says, Mimacharas HaShabbos, that you count Tisperuch HaMishim Yom from after Shabbos. So the Sadducees would literally wait for Saturday night. They would calculate Shavuos based on after Shabbos. The rabbi said, that's not what the text means. In this context, Yom Tif is called Shabbos. Mimacharas HaShabbos means after Pesach you begin the count, after the first day. Not literally Saturday night. I'm giving you these three examples to show you that everything I described to you is biblical law. But the rabbis, we needed and invited and we rely and lean on the rabbis to tell us what the authentic biblical law is all along. And then we have the Torah Shabbat Peh. I'll give you one last example, I'm sorry. One last example, okay, Rabbi Billy. One last example because it's significant. This past Sukkot, everyone took a lulav, we all took hadas, and we all took a ravos. And what kind of fruit did everyone take? Is there anyone in this room who did not, for the mitzvah of Dalad Minim, take an esrog? Can anyone tell me which verse, which chapter, which parsha in our sacred Chumash it tells us that we have to take an esrog on Sukkot? Anyone can tell me? It does not. It says in Emor that you have to take what? A pre-eights? A beautiful, magnificent citrus fruit. Anyone familiar with how many species of citrus fruit there are? I have no idea, but it's a lot. It's a lot. I actually know that because someone just asked me a great question in my community. They bought a tree from Home Depot that produces six separate type of fruit. It was grafted together. It's a hybrid tree. And this one tree you put in your backyard, it grows a lemon, a grapefruit, an orange, a tangerine, face, all these fruit. And when I was researching the Shiloh, I saw that there's an artist who grafted 40 branches and created a tree that can grow 40 different fruit that are 40 different colors. And he's recreated the tree now. You can buy one. I think it's $30,000. You plant it in your backyard. Your tree can grow 40 separate kinds of fruit. So this is a big question. Can you plant a tree like this? Can you benefit, eat the fruit of a tree like this? I recently was with Rav Asher Weiss, the Menchas Asher. I asked him, he was so excited. He said, could you send it to me in an email so I could write a tshuva about it? There's a Chazon Ish who says that if all of the fruit are citrus, maybe they're one family. It's not called kelayim. But there's many, 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 many species of citrus fruit. How do you know pre-Eitz Hadar means an Ezra? How do you know it? I'll tell you how you know it. The rabbis. The Torah Sheba'al Peh had a tradition, Misinai, that when the Torah says generically a beautiful citrus fruit, it doesn't mean an orange or a lemon or a grapefruit. It means an esrog. And the Rambam writes that you go anywhere in the world, through any time in Jewish history, and you will find in every Jewish community on Sukkot, they're taking the exact same fruit. And the Rambam writes, almost emotionally, is there a greater testament to the staying power, to the sustainability, to the authority of Torah Sheba'al Peh through the ages, than the fact that you go to any community anywhere in the world at any time, and they're all taking the same citrus fruit that the Torah never told us specifically will. So that's all biblical law. Explicit biblical law, derived biblical law from the 13 hermeneutical principles, and Torah, Halacha of Moshe Mi-Sinai, the laws that we have a tradition that God gave to Moshe that he continued to pass down. But that's not my topic for tonight. My topic is to contrast that life with the power the rabbis had to not interpret or reveal or expose the biblical law, but to introduce their own new law. What are examples of new laws that the rabbis introduced? Well, we're going to observe one in a couple days. It's a holiday. You may have heard of it. It's called Purim. Hanukkah and Purim are two entirely rabbinic holidays. But we have many, many rabbinic laws that regulate and legislate our lives each and every day. I'm going to give you some examples of them in a moment. But the question is, by what right, with what authority, do the rabbis introduce new laws? We have the Torah. And okay, fine, we even have the tradition that was passed on about how to understand the Torah. But with what authority can the rabbis introduce new law? So, this is a machlokas, a famous debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Rambam points us to a verse, the pasuk in Parshas Shoftim. Lo sasam in adavar she'agidu l'cha yamin v'smol. Do not stray from the words of the rabbis, right or left. Which Rashi quotes as Sifri says, even if they tell you right is left and left is right, meaning even if they're wrong, listen to them anyway. It's a very difficult question. The rabbis tell you that the meat and milk that are mixed together, which is for sure not kosher, but they tell you it's kosher, you should listen to them even if they're wrong. It's a very difficult sifri. The Ram, Rabbeinu Nissim asks, I don't understand. A medical conference, they get together and all the doctors vote that something which is poisonous is really medicine, doesn't mean it's not going to kill you if you take it, just because they all voted that way. So if the rabbis are wrong, and the food, in fact, is spiritually poisonous, then why should it be okay to eat it just because they voted that way? It's an excellent question. The Ron has a great answer, and we don't have time for it tonight. But the Rambam says that is... I have to make sure I get invited back to Boynton in the future. The Rambam says that is the source of rabbinic law. Do not stray. God empowered the rabbis. God says, look, I only spoke to you once. I only got through two commandments. I couldn't even get beyond that without you guys getting all scared. So I'm empowering the rabbis to be my mouthpiece, my spokesperson, my advocates in the world to help create a world based on my vision. They have the authority. Says God, I'm deputizing Chazal, the rabbis. They can institute new laws. The Ramban asks a famous question on the Rambam. And the Ramban says, I don't understand. If following the rabbis is really a biblical law because you derive it from Bosasur, then why do we have a rule that Safek Deoraisa is L'chumra? When you're not sure if you did a biblical rule right, then you have to be strict to do it again. And Safek Derabbanan, thank you, is L'kula. If you're unsure or you have doubt on a rabbinic law, then you're lenient. Ask the Ramban and the Rambam if the Rambam's right, that the authority of the rabbis derives from a biblical pasuk and law, then every rabbinic law is really a biblical law. Every derabbanan is a deraisa. So why are we lenient on a rabbinical law and strict on a biblical law? We should be strict on all laws. They're really all biblical. A bam kasha, you'd call it. It's a great question, a compelling question the Ramban asks in the Rambam. So the defenders of the Rambam and the Rambam himself, the Rashba weighs in, all these different medieval commentaries will say, no, that whole rule that you're strict on a biblical doubt and lenient on a rabbinic doubt is a rabbinic law. So since that whole law is a rabbinic law, the rabbis were able to differentiate in the way that they applied it. Others explain differently. But then you're left with the question of the Ramban. According to you, Rabbi Ramban, according to you, Rav Nachman ben Maimon, that we do not learn the rabbi's authority from Lo Sasur. According to you, Ramban, from where do rabbis derive the authority to institute new laws? And much ink has been spilled on this question. Rav Elchanan Wasserman has a long essay, Meshech Chochma and others. Rav Elchanan's theory is that we have a new category called Ratzon Hashem, the will of the Almighty. Rabbis were empowered to anticipate, to represent, to express the Ratzon Hashem, the will of the Almighty. So within every rabbinic law is not a biblical law from Lo Sasur. It's that the rabbis were empowered to reveal the will of the Almighty. That's not a biblical law. It is a rabbinic law. But I want to, in our remaining time, and then we'll have time for questions, I want to give you three areas of life where the rabbis came and made such significant contributions that it entirely transformed the way that we observe that area of our life. And when I describe to you how much of what we do is rabbinic, you won't even recognize, it'll be totally unfamiliar to us what it was like to live when only biblical law was being observed before the rabbis introduced these laws. And the first area I'll tell you about is Shabbos. The three areas we're going to talk about are in some ways the three areas that we use to define or to identify a Jew, an observant Jew. Shabbos, Kashrus, and Davening. Those are the three areas. So number one, Shabbos. Number one, Shabbos. To us, Shabbos is a day of retreat. It's a day of being passive. It's a day of being at peace with nature, with the world around us. 6 days of work, go multiply, fill the world and conquer it. Manipulate nature, conquer the world, scientific discovery, technological advancement. Come Shabbos, peaceful, quiet. The ideal Shabbos for us, you daven, you go home, you have a nice meal, you learn, you have a nice shluf, you have conversation. Shabbos to us is synonymous with the davening at shul and being at home. If I would tell you, Rabbi Billa, what are you doing this Saturday? Would you like to go to the mall with me shopping?
I'm working.
You're working, I know. We work on Shabbos. Hypocrites, those rabbis. So Rabbi Billa, what are you doing this Shabbos? Would you come to the mall shopping with me? You would look at me and say, Shagetz, what kind of rabbi are you? Shopping? The mall? Shabbos? Usser, Pasnish, what's the matter with you? Do you know that prior to the introduction of rabbinic laws of Shabbos, not biblical laws interpreted by the rabbis, but purely rabbinic laws, Shabbos, Rav Asher Weiss said this recently, quoting him, that Shabbos was a day of buying and selling and shopping and the marketplace. Why is it that we can't buy and sell? Think about it for a moment. Why can't you go to a store and buy anything on Shabbos? It would be convenient. There's a reason that malls are open on the weekends, and that is the day designated that most people do their shopping. It's when you have time. It would be convenient. So why is it forbidden? Why don't we go shopping on Shabbos? If you get to travel, you have no biblical laws, you're not getting in a car. If you can walk down the block to the bodega, you can walk down the block to the mall, look at some nice dresses, some nice outfits. What's preventing us from doing that? Someone said malacha. What malacha? What malacha? I walk down the block to the store. Say there's no electrical door. I walk in. There's a cold bottle of water in the fridge. No light goes on when they open it. They hand me the cold bottle of water. I'd like to buy. What malacha is involved? I'm not writing anything. I'm not signing the credit card. I'm working in cash. Cash business. I got cash in my pocket. I'm going to go buy whatever I'm going to buy. I'm going to pay cash. What is the problem? First of all, you can't walk out now. Right? You can't. Don't leave till we get to the punchline of this. But what is the problem with shopping on Shabbos? If I'm not writing, and I'm not lighting a fire, I'm not going in a car, I'm not using an electric door, I walk into a place, I purchase an item, I pay with cash, what's the problem? What? It's a non-Jew, the store's open anyway, I'm not making them work, what's the problem? There's an Eruv, I'm not carrying, what's the problem with carrying? Mar Zion only exists when something is forbidden. But if it's permissible, then there's no Mar Zion. So what's the problem? Shomo Vazach. I'm doing Shomo Vazach. I made Kiddush. I made Havdom at the end of Shabbos. I'm not doing any of the 39 Malachas. What's the problem? This is fun. Doing business. Excellent. What's your name? Chedva. Chedva says the problem is Mekach u'Memkar. The problem is you're not allowed to do business. Chedva, where does it say you're not allowed to do business? Which of the Lamentes Malachos, which of the 39 categories of creative labor is doing business? The answer, I'll help you out here. The answer is none of the above. There is no biblical prohibition to do business. The rabbis came along and said, if you do business, you're going to end up writing. You're going to keep a record, you're going to balance your checkbook, you're going to ask for the invoice, you're going to write down the receipt. Because they understood you likely would come to write, they said, Mekach u'Memkar is asur. Business is forbidden. What about the money? How was I going to use cash? Isn't that muktza? What's muktza? Which of the 39 categories of creative labor is muktza? Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam shehakol nehiyeh bedvaro. Which of the 39 categories of creative labor is muktza? I'll save us all some time. None of the above. Muktza is a rabbinic law. Why did the rabbis introduce muktza? It's a great debate. The Rambam, the Raiva, the Rambam is a great reason. Because they understood that if you don't introduce muktza, you could be observing the law of Shabbos but violating the spirit of Shabbos. And in order to preserve the spirit of Shabbos, they introduced the rules of muktza, that you can't touch things that you shouldn't be using on Shabbos. They made a Shabbos atmosphere. Shabbos dick. The spirit of Shabbos. But muktzah is not a biblical law. So that means to say, I just want to describe to you, and this is not me, the great Minchas Hashem of Moshe Weiss described, that prior to Anshei Knesset HaGedolah introducing the prohibition of Mekach u'Memkar, before they said you're not allowed to do business because you may write, and before they said there's such a thing as muktzah, do you know how Saturdays were likely spent in the time of the temple? At the mall. So you talk about a transition from a biblical lifestyle to the rabbinic lifestyle. During the biblical times, when did you buy your korbanos? When did you buy all that accompanied them? Shabbos! The rabbis came along and introduced what became the necessary fences and borders and boundaries that have given us the Shabbos we know. That means to say that if you went back in time to temple times, and went to Yerushalayim and saw the most righteous, the most religious of the time, you'd look at them and you'd say, I can't even eat in your home. I wouldn't let you date my children. Unless you knew the difference between biblical law and rabbinic law and understood that chronologically, sequentially, you went back in time before these rabbinic laws were ever even really introduced. Shabbos was likely unlike anything we know today. Which brings us to the second category. Because what takes up the bulk of our morning every Shabbos? And we have to come back and do it again in the afternoon. And we got to catch one more of it before Shabbos can leave. And we go Friday night for a longer version than the rest of the time. What are we busy doing? Davening. Well, who instituted davening? During the biblical time, during temple times and biblical times, you didn't daven. You had to say Shema. It doesn't take very long. And that was it. There was no shul. Yes, we have archaeologically, they discovered shuls that were contemporaneous to the temple, but they had to do it the ma'amados, the representative from the community whose whose parallel we're going to serve. The Kohanim Levim were going to the temple that week for their rotation. The Yisraelim of the community would stay back and have to say certain prayers and fast and participate in their way. That's likely how the shuls were used. But the average citizen did not go to a shul. You were not a member of a shul. There wasn't a shul you were a member of. You weren't a member. Which minyan did you go to? Did you sponsor the kiddush? What level of membership did you join? There were no shuls during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. At least in this, there might have been a place of gathering for a different purpose. But in the classic sense of what we think of as a shul, to daven three times a day or more, Shabbos, Yom Tov, Yom Kippur, they didn't exist. There's a machlokas Ramban and Rambam whether we're even biblically obligated to daven every day. Rambam says you have to daven every day once a day, and Ramban says be'ez tzara, only in a time of great need, crisis. Rabbi Soloveitchik famously explained that the Ramban and the Rambam are not really arguing. They both agree that the catalyst which stimulates the obligation to daven is crisis, is need. According to one, only when a real crisis arises are you obligated. According to the other, every day that you're alive is a crisis, especially if you're Jewish. Every day is a crisis. Just to breathe, for your feet to walk, to avoid a car accident, to have food to eat, a roof over your head, to get through the day, for our kids to be in school and not evacuated from a bomb threat, to have a cemetery where the tombstones are not overturned, every day is a crisis. So there's a debate whether you even have to daven every day, but you know, according to the Magen Avraham, you yotzei davening every day with modani. You yotzei davening just saying, thanks Hashem for my being here. There was no Shmona Esrei. There was no Psukei Dezimra, no Birchas HaShachar, no Birchas Kriya Shema, no Asher Yevalu Tzion. None of them. So in temple times, biblical Judaism, there was no shul, there was no davening. There were no zmanim of davening. There were no times. Got to get shacharis in only after this time and before this time. Mincha starts only at this time, got to be done by that time. Mar only after that time, make sure you finish. But doesn't exist. Did not exist. And the third area is kashrus. Kashrus. Would you eat in the home of somebody who eats chicken parmesan? Would you eat in the home of somebody who says, come for dinner, I'm serving chicken with mozzarella cheese and whatever else goes into chicken parmesan? I don't have a clue. Would you eat in someone's home, serve chicken parmesan? I wouldn't. Pasnish. I can't go out. My kids can't go out with their kid. You crazy? Before the rabbis came and instituted the prohibition of of v'chalav, poultry and milk, biblically speaking, it's perfectly permissible. From the Torah, during biblical law times, the only thing forbidden was meat and milk. But chicken or poultry and milk, it's not a problem. Chicken is not meat. Lo sevasho gedi b'chalev imo, you can't cook a kid in some other's milk, refers to meat. Chicken is not meat. So, during biblical times, and continuing in the community of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, even after, you could have chicken parmesan, which is clearly the only poultry and milk dish I can think of. You can have chicken parmesan. What happened? The rabbis came along and very astutely said, most people think about chicken like it's meat. Even if you don't keep kosher, even if you're not Jewish, in your mind you categorize chicken and meat. Go in the supermarket, it's in the same section. Chicken and meat go together. And if we allow you to keep eating chicken and milk, you will likely end up eating meat and milk. So the rabbi said, let's draw a fence around this. It's a good idea. But again, think about how different our kashrus, our eating lives are than in biblical times. That's rabbinic Judaism. I'll give you another example. Why do we have, does anyone here have two sets of dishes, meat and milk? Does anyone use one set? Don't answer that. One set of dishes for meat and milk. Why do we have two separate dishes for meat and milk? Why? The answer is because we believe tam ki'ikar. Long sugyas throughout Shas that taste, even when there's no presence of anything tangible, taste, intangible taste, is meaningful. So when my pot is sparkling clean, but it's previously absorbed taste of non-kosher, then that taste is meaningful, just like it absorbed the taste, it could purge the taste into the next food I'll cook in the pot. It's a problem. So if I have a treif pot, a pot that cooked non-kosher, clean, sparkling clean, and I then cook kosher in it, how did it become non-kosher? It was a sparkling clean pot. The answer is, tam ki'ikar. The taste embedded in the wall of the pot leaves the wall of the pot into my food, and now I've got a problem. I'm eating the non-kosher taste that became transferred. We have another rule. It's called nosein tam lefgam, that a stale taste, an inedible taste, is not halachically meaningful. So, here's the rule. When that non-kosher taste became embedded in the wall of my pot, but 24 hours have passed, the taste that's in the wall of the pot is now stale, it's inedible, it's no longer halachically meaningful. So they'll say to me, does that mean that all I have to do is wait 24 hours and I could use even a non-kosher pot to cook kosher? And the answer is, sort of. During biblical times, the answer was, sure. Because it's now a kosher pot. Wait 24 hours and it's a kosher pot. Which is why when there's a mix-up in your kitchen or your dishwasher, you call Rabbi Billet, and the first question Rabbi Billet asks you is, when was the last time it was used? Was it used within 24 hours? For meat, for dairy, and so on. So why is it we have two sets of dishes? Why don't we just wait? Now, the truth is, there's a difference between Isser and Heter. And I don't want to get into the details here. I don't want to lose the forest for the trees. But let's talk Heter, in the world of permissible. Basar b'chol of meat and milk is Heter v'Heter. Meat is kosher, milk is kosher, meat and milk, not kosher. So, why do I have to have two sets of dishes? One for meat, one for dairy. Why can't I just use it for meat, clean it well, wait 24 hours, and use it for dairy? Clean it well, wait 24 hours, use it for meat. Why can't I go back and forth? So you may be very shocked to learn that one of the Rishonim, the Ra'ah, did exactly that. The Ra'ah says that the Gzeira Eino Ben Yomo Atu Ben Yomo only applies to Isura, not to Hetera. The rabbis came along, and the rabbis said, even though strictly speaking, even a non-kosher pot, you wait 24 hours and you're good to go, but you know what's going to happen? You're not exact about 24 hours. You're going to guesstimate. We can barely wait the 6 hours, 3 hours, meat and milk. We get all confused. You're going to remember each pot, each dish, each utensil, each fork, each knife has its own clock running. You're going to have little clocks all over your kitchen, little notes, little post-it notes, little tags, write down. You're going to have an app on your phone for each fork and each knife. You'll never be able to maintain the 24-hour clock of everything to say, I could take something non-kosher, just wait 24 hours and use it again. So the rabbi said, don't use eno ben yomo, atu ben yomo. You got to have separate dishes, meat and milk, because even if you think you're waiting 24 hours in between to use it, you may confuse it. Atu ben yomo, you'll do it within 24 hours, and now you got a real halachic problem. The ra'ah said, that only applies to non-kosher. The rabbi's enactment that said, you need two separate dishes, does not apply to meat and milk. In the house of the ra'ah was the Rebbe of the Ritva, in the house of the ra'ah, there was one set of dishes for meat and milk. We don't accept that opinion, halacha l'maisa, practically speaking. We have two sets of dishes. I'm giving you an example, that, again, in the world of kashrus, one we gave was poultry and milk, which biblically speaking is perfectly permissible. And before the rabbis enacted it, Jews were eating the most erlach, hamisha, from Jews were eating chicken parmesan. And before the rabbis enacted eino ben yomo atu ben yomo, the most righteous Jews could take a non-kosher pot, and as long as 24 hours passed, they could cook something kosher in it. So these are three distinct examples of how in biblical times, before the rabbis introduced their rules, not before the rabbis revealed the biblical law, but before the rabbis introduced their laws, that lifestyle and observance was unfamiliar to us. It was so categorically different than anything we know. Shabbos, davening, and kashrus. Rav Asher Weiss, I heard him speak recently, and he said in the name of his father, Zichrono Livracha, and then of course Rav Asher Weiss knows everything, so he said that he later found it in Rabbi Yonah Salachitson, the Yaros Dvash, Chelek Aleph Siman Vav. Although I looked there, he doesn't say exactly the same thing. He alludes to it. He says that Anshe Knesset HaGedola, our rabbis, by adding the restrictions and the rules and the regulations in these three areas, saved Judaism. Saved Judaism. Do you know that Ezra, when he called the Jews back to Israel, and I just left the Nefesh B'Nefesh event at my shul, Rabbi Fass and Tony Gelbart, to celebrate the Ezra of our day. But when Ezra brought the Jews back to Israel, how many went? Anyone know? 42,000 Jews. 43,000 Jews. The overwhelming majority remained behind, and not only did they remain behind, they intermarried and they assimilated. How many years had it been that they were in exile? 70 years. It was like that, a blink of an eye. In 70 years, everything fell apart. In 70 years, intermarriage, assimilation, and a failure to heed the call and return. And yet, 2,000 years, we were in exile, and we got it going. 2,000 years, we were in exile, we still have a vibrant, strong, observant Torah community. How's it possible that in 70 years, the time of Ezra, they were lost? And 2,000 years, we've been able to persevere and survive in the exile. And said Rav Asher Weiss, it was the brilliance, it was the prophecy, the prescient wisdom of our rabbis, of Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, of Chazal. The Gemara Gittin and Zion tells us that when Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, the whole interaction where he called them the Caesar and Vespasian, he anticipated and give me anything you want, the Yavna v'Chachmah, and he migrated the Jewish world to Yavna, Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai anticipated a new world, a new Jewish experience. How would the Jews survive without the Beis HaMikdash at our core? How would we survive without Karbanos and without the Sanhedrin? And he and his colleagues anticipated and enacted all these rules that make Judaism almost unrecognizable today the way it was then, but became the secret for our survival. Things did not fall apart. Here we are after 2,000 years because they put in place things that would observe Shabbos. They put in place rules that would help us maintain kashrus. They put in place an entire system of davening and shuls that would help create community even in a post-temple era. And I want to end with the following thought. Rabbis today do not enact new laws. We don't have the power of Lo Sasur. The Rambam, the Ramban, the Ratzon Hashem. The rabbis of today, it's not even the real smicha of the Ish Mipi Ish, we don't have that power. We don't enact new laws. But the rabbis of today are still entrusted with being the Balei HaMesorah. We are still entrusted with looking around the world and trying to make sense of it, of trying to put in place, to interpret, to enact rules and regulations that will help us not only survive, but help us thrive. Sefer HaChinuch references the Gemara's comment in Rosh Hashanah. It says that you go to the Shofet HaShiyah Bayamim Ahem. You'll go to the judge in your day. And the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says, what does it mean, the judge in your day? The Gemara says, Yiftach Bedoro Keshmuel Bedoro. Yiftach, the lowliest of the judges, was nevertheless an authority for his generation, like Shmuel, the greatest, was in his generation. Yiftach Bedoro Keshmuel Bedoro. We don't always get to choose who our leaders are, and we may not always be enamored and impressed, but the leaders of a generation have authority. They are endowed with a certain wisdom. They are entrusted with the transmission of the Mesorah of our sacred tradition and of helping to reinforce a world and a lifestyle in which Judaism will not dissolve, will not disappear, we will not assimilate, we will not only survive, but we will thrive. And on this, the Sefer HaChinuch says something incredible. Sefer HaChinuch says, whoever does not obey the advice of the Gedolei Torah of their generation violates this commandment of Lo Sasur, of Yiftach Bedoro Kishmo Bedoro. Because it is an amud, it is one of the pillars that the Torah relies upon. And so as we're living in a world of rapid change, as we're living in a world of different segments of the Jewish community trying to advance all kinds of changes, we turn to and lean on the Balei HaMesorah, the Gedolim of our generation. To be a Gadol is not about information. Today we have Google and Bar Ilan and Otzer HaChachma. We have data and information at our fingertips. It is the information age. To be a member of the Mesorah, entrusted with the transmission of the Mesorah, to be a Gadol B'Yisrael is not about having the most information or data, it's about having wisdom. Wisdom is life experience. Wisdom is apprenticeship, and it's serving those who came before, who are the Gedolei Yisrael. Wisdom is when you are turned to. So as we're looking for advice and instruction and authority on which changes are legitimate and from within, which are foreign and from without, we don't turn to people as bright and brilliant, as great, as genius as they may be, as much information or data they've collected, we turn to the people who are the Balei HaMesorah, the Gedolim, the Rosh Yeshiva of our time, the Poskim. Those who are turned to for life and death decisions. Those who are turned to when there's a case of an aguna. Those who are turned to understand complicated new technological breakthroughs in kashrus or Shabbos. Just as we trust them. Rabbi Billet and I and all of our colleagues call them when there's a life and death issue and an aguna issue and so on. They are the ones we trust to guide us of where the boundaries are and when they're being pushed too hard and too fast. So this topic tonight, the transition from a biblical lifestyle to a rabbinic one, a biblical Judaism to the rabbinic world. I hope you got a little glimpse through the three examples we explored, and there's so many more, that the Torah lifestyle that we know now would be unrecognizable and unfamiliar to those who came before us, just as their life might be unfamiliar to us. But what brilliance of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah and our rabbis who put our lifestyle in place that has enabled us and supported us to survive throughout all of these years and beyond. Thank you so much for having me. Any questions? Yes. Same rule. Because chametz, technically speaking, after 24 hours, it's gone. Chametz is stricter than most things because it's also b'mashir. Even a trace of chametz is a problem. But it's the same rule we were talking about. Because it's absorbed in the utensil, and we are not trusted to calculate 24 hours accurately, therefore we have separate utensils for everything. Yes?
What happens with glass utensils?
Glass utensils depends if you're Sephardi or Ashkenazi. Glass is not porous. Sephardim are lenient when it comes to glass, even when it comes to Pesach. Ashkenazim are strict when it comes to glass for Pesach, and we believe glass can't be kosher. The exception of a glass top stove, which Rabbi Billet in his pre-Pesach workshop I'm sure will cover. Yes? Cold glass. Glass which was only used for cold can be kosher and used, but glass which was used for hot, a Pyrex dish, we do not believe can be kosher for Pesach, though Sephardim believe it can. Any questions on that? On the top, not ask the rabbi halacha questions, but yes. Fish and meat. Fish and meat is a Gemara Psachim. The Gemara says that if you have fish and meat, it's kashul adava acher. It leads to another kind of illness. Which Rashi on the spot says, what's the other illness? Tzaras. Now, it does not mean that you break out in leprosy from fish and meat, although tzaras, psoriasis, some say that there is some connection between fish and meat leading to psoriasis, tzaras, but that's likely scientifically inaccurate. At that time, fish and meat was a health concern. It never was a religious concern. It's always been a purely health concern. It's one of those areas where do you say nishtanu hatfaim, that the nature has changed. Because today, fish and meat does not pose any health danger to us at all. So the Magen Avraham, Avraham Gambiner in the 17th century says that fish and meat are no longer prohibited. And that you can have fish and meat together, you can use the same utensil for it, because we no longer have that same health concern. Others say, no, Rav Avadia Yosef says, no, chamira sakanta meisura. We're even stricter when it comes to danger than we are with religious prohibition. So, for example, do you apply the rules of bittul to fish and meat? If you have anchovies and salad dressing, do you have to list that it's fish? Can you have salad dressing with anchovies with meat? Do you apply the rules of bittul nullification? Rav Avadia has a tshuva and he entertains that we should be strict because chamira sakanta meisura. We're even more cautious with danger than we are with religious rule. However, we are lenient in that area. I believe that the OU, which sometimes has a fish label or F, but that's only if there's not enough ratio for it to be nullified. So that's the origin of... There's a Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, in his commentary, says in one place that you can't have fish and milk. So the Bach says about the Beis Yosef, Nis'arav le-Beis Yosef basar b'chalav. The Beis Yosef got confused. It's a cute play on words. Nisara of the Beis Yosef, Basar B'chalav. The Beis Yosef got confused. He mixed up meat and milk. So Ashkenazim aren't strict about that, but Sephardim do. Any Sephardim here? Sephardim will not have... I can't think of anything that's fish and...
Cheese.
What's fish and... Fish fried in butter, fish with melted cheese on top. Sephardim will be strict like the Beis Yosef, but Ashkenazim are lenient. Yes?
Confused.
Right.
Who's to choose the God of the door today? There's so much focus between the various factions within Judaism.
Excellent question. And it's an excellent question, and one that I look forward to hearing what Rabbi Billet says about it. But I'll tell you very quickly. The question was, I've set up a system, not I. The system is set up, and the Sefer HaChinuch writes it most explicitly, that the notion of deferring to the leaders of the generation to understand and interpret and apply is true in every generation, even after the close of the Talmud. That the principles of Lo Sasur and Yiftach Bedoro Kishmul Bedoro applies even in 2017, maybe especially in 2017. So the very fair question was, well, who decides? Who are the rabbis of the generation? They get to decide. You got a list of rabbis on this side, you got a list of rabbis on that side. To which my answer is that not all rabbis are equal. For example, I'm not one of the rabbis. I know my place. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the experience. I don't have the wisdom. I don't have the age. I don't have the authority. And I'm not turned to for that position. And we should not confuse that because the rabbi is brilliant and can pen essays and svarim and quote sources by heart, that that makes him an authority on these issues. As I said, what makes one of the Balei HaMasorah is when they de facto are turned to by the community for guidance, for instruction, when they're the ones we lean on for the life and death shilas, for the aguna cases, for the new breakthroughs. If you want to know, there's microscopic insects in water and can you drink it? And there's this problem with that and can you do it? And how do we deal with the fact that alarm systems or cameras are at the Kotel? It's not just that some brilliant rabbi who nobody heard of can write an essay that makes an argument why something is allowed. That doesn't make them an authority because they're brilliant. Not everybody's equal. What makes one an authority is because they have emerged to be an authority. We know who those individuals are. And if you're not sure who they are, ask the rabbis who they call when they're stuck. And the ones that the rabbis call when they need that leniency, when they need those broad shoulders, when they need that authority, those are the Chachmei Hador, the Balei of Masorah of that generation. Okay, we got to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for having me, and have a wonderful evening.